I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a sport-tuned suspension. Learn more at Acura.com.
Good morning, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Pig Iron Theater Company was founded back in 1995 and since then has earned a reputation for staging an eclectic range of original productions that defy category. It calls itself a dance clown theater ensemble. This year, as in past years, it's part of the Philadelphia Live Arts Fringe Festival, which opens tomorrow and runs for 2 weeks through September 15th. Pig Iron is premiering Isabella, drawn from Shakespeare's play Measure for Measure. It was written near the end of Shakespeare's life and has been described as a problem play. It's about death and obsessive sex, and yet it's called a comedy. Pig Iron set the production in an antiseptic morgue. The actors are naked. Today on Radio Times, meet some of the people involved in Pig Iron's Isabella, and they join us here in our Philadelphia studios. Dan Rothenberg is director of this play. He's a founding member of Pig Iron and one of the three artistic directors. Dan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Brian.
You're welcome. Charles Cromwell is a performer in Isabella. In fact, he plays the mortician, the Duke. He's a professor at the University of the Arts, where he created the stage combat program back in 1985. Charles Cromwell, nice to have you with us. Good morning.
Thank you.
And Lisi Stossel, also with us, the associate set designer, makeup designer for Isabella. She's a graduate student at the University of Virginia. Lisi, nice to have you with us as well. Good morning.
Good to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And to you, Dan, let me start with you, because this play, Measure for Measure, has been described as a problem play. Mm-hmm. Did that intrigue you? Did that make you think, let's explore this play and see what we can find out about it?
Yes, definitely. You know, a few years back, Pig Iron typically starts without a script, and we make all original work. It's a collaboration between the actor creators. We collaborate with writers, sometimes choreographers, sometimes a visual artist like a sculptor or a puppet designer. And typically the first day of rehearsal, there is no script in hand. We'll always begin on our feet with the idea that we're developing performance works that the best kind of performance works for us are the works which evolve in tandem, in which the design and the language evolves together. A few years ago, the Public Theater in New York asked us, well, what would you do with Shakespeare? And we
intriguing question, right?
Yeah. I mean, actually, we had certainly talked about Shakespeare for a long time. A lot of us were lovers of Shakespeare's language, although not always of the Shakespeare performances, as she has spoke, usually. It seemed at the time that we really didn't want to attack a masterpiece first, that we wanted to attack a piece which had problems, because we think of what we do sometimes as translation. Taking things in one medium and putting them into another medium. So we were interested in, exactly as you say, that it was a problem play, because it seemed there was definitely some work to be done on it.
And when people call this, though, a problem play, I mean, you're not the first. It's the one of the descriptions of Measure for Measure. A problem why?
Well,
a problem for whom?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny... I think it's in the middle of the 20th century that critics started calling these plays that were written around 1603 problem plays. And the plays actually are, they talk about these problem comedies, All's Well That Ends Well and Measure for Measure, as well as a couple of other plays written around 1603, Hamlet and Troilus and Cressida.
Huh.
And there's a lot of, I think first of all, you know, Hamlet has a storied history, but Measure for Measure and All's Well That Ends Well were not done for a long time. Part of the reason just simply is people said, well, they're unsatisfying as comedies. They're not funny. The kind of humor is very different from the earlier Elizabethan comedies in Shakespeare's careers. And actually, my own take on it is that Shakespeare's moving from writing comedies to writing tragedies, but either there's still a market for comedies at that moment at 1603, or he hasn't figured out that that's really what he wants to write. And really, it's about the end of possibility, the end of the limits of imagination. So his early plays are really about all the possibilities of imagination and wordplay, And the later plays are about how that's just not enough in the face of death and finality.
Maybe as he was facing his own mortality.
Clearly something was changing in his life at this time.
Let me turn to you, Charles Cromwell, because you play the Duke, the mortician, in this production of Isabella. How did you think about that character? Who is that character?
Well, he's a lonely man who spends his entire working day with the dead. And he goes home, he has no friends, but he goes home at night and reads Shakespeare.
That's how you conceived of him.
I couldn't imagine doing this production if the mortician was unfamiliar with Shakespeare. And I hope the audience sees this. I try to get the idea to do Measure for Measure a couple of minutes into the show. I try to let that happen spontaneously.
And he's lonely because he works at the morgue, or he works at the morgue because he's lonely?
I don't know the answer to that. He is lonely. He has no friends outside the morgue, and he's obviously chosen a profession, an odd choice. So he's lonely in two ways. His professional life is without the living, and his personal life is without friends.
Did you go to a morgue in preparation for this?
We did. We went to the morgue at Jefferson Hospital, and Mike Price, the coroner, was a terrific help, and he talks to his corpses.
Oh, he does?
As I do. And
makes sense.
I always think, just before I go on stage, I always think about the Jefferson Morgue and the door, because the first thing I do is enter. And so that was tremendously helpful.
To be able to kind of place somebody in a morgue.
To have that environment and to hear him talk about that.
Right. Let me turn to you, Lisi, because you do the makeup for the bodies in this play, Isabel, and I'm assuming going to a morgue was helpful for you as well, right?
It was. We didn't actually get to view any bodies. That was something that I was considering doing during my research period, but it's extremely hard to get access to dead people for whatever reason. So the morgue was more helpful just to get a sense of the environment of this place. And I guess as the associate set designer, I had a lot of input in the props and aesthetically what they looked like. And so going to the morgue and seeing certain surprising tools there, for example, was really helpful in choosing, making those choices.
Well, I was reading that something called lividity was a challenge, and I guess as bodies decompose, we're talking about this obviously on the radio, but as bodies decompose, certain things happen to the skin.
Yeah, that was the most surprising thing about my research. I personally didn't know what lividity was when I started researching, and what happens essentially is when you die in a certain position, your blood pools to, according to gravity, to the lowest point. And it makes this rather surprising-looking bruise that's very extensive and comes in all sorts of surprising purples and reds. And every time I mention that to somebody, they say, "Oh, lividity, what's that?" And it's kind of shocking that it's something that happens to every single body.
But we don't know about it.
Yeah, it's as common as acne in teenagers, you know.
And that's what an embalmer is hired to hide.
Is to hide. Exactly. And was that painted on? What we see are the, what looks almost like bruising, as obviously as the blood goes to a certain part of the body.
Mm-hmm. That's just the regular stage makeup with a sea sponge.
With a sea sponge.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the bodies look like it's sort of a kind of a wash of makeup.
It's a general paling with some yellow and white to get sort of that waxy. A lot of corpses get jaundiced.
You want to add to that, Dan?
Well, like Lisi, it was something I didn't know, and I think it really speaks to how little time we spend in the presence of death and of dead bodies, and how much effort our culture puts into covering things up and making things pretty. Both that it's called pallor mortis, which is the paleness of death, and livor mortis, which is this bluish redness of death, that actually we put Lisi puts a lot of effort into. She did this sort of remarkable process where she would lie people down on paint and then take paint
impressions.
Yeah, take paint impressions to get a sense of where the blood would have pooled. So there's all this effort into creating a realism, which is actually not what we're known for in this one.
A new experience for you, right?
Very much. This photorealism, but still almost nobody knows what it is when they come in and they wonder, oh, these people burned, what happened? But as Lisi says, it's one of the first things that happens.
Yeah.
It happens in a few hours that lividity develops.
And then, of course, there's rigor mortis that sets in, and you've got these bodies which you have to kind of work and unfold, Charles, to make, I guess, dance or move within the space.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of morticians are pretty big guys because they have to lift up literally dead weight, and breaking the rigor mortis is physical work. Mm-hmm. It's difficult.
And was it? I mean, I was watching you sort of pull an arm, pull a leg out, and get it
well,
to
my
lie
flat. My leading lady really gives me a lot of resistance.
Yes, she does.
So
I noticed that
the effort you saw is quite real.
Trying to pull her arm out. We should also say, and I'm back to you, Dan, is that this is done almost entirely with naked actors, and I wonder if that was something you had to think through differently from other performances that you've done.
Oh, yeah.
Is this a big deal to be naked on stage?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's certainly been a range of feelings about it in the cast, but I think probably most of all that I didn't want it to be gratuitous, that I wanted it to be, if I was going to do a piece with nudity in it, I didn't want it to be gratuitous, and actually I didn't want it to be sexy.
Oh. This is a play in part about sex, is it not?
Absolutely. I think it's a play about sexual desire, but the way that we use the nudity in the play is, to me, very awkward. I should say that it's not even... I don't even think of it really as an adaptation of Measure for Measure, but I think of it as really this original work about the body as an object, and both about the fear of death in the fear of becoming an object, and the strange transaction that takes place in sexual desire and in beauty and in viewing someone else's body as an object and wondering where the attraction comes from. Does it come from inside you, or does it come from this object that has power over you? Really, I've been talking about the play as I was talking about translation earlier, and I was saying that there's really these two lines in Shakespeare's play that we've pulled out and made into a big visual world. And one line is Angelo. He's when he suddenly sees with desire for this nun, he says, "Who sins most, the tempter or the tempted?" And then he moves on to this image of decomposition, which is what sparked the idea of the morgue, which is not she, nor does she tempt, but it is I who, lying by the violet in the sun, do as the carrion does, not as the flower, corrupt with virtuous season. And the second line is this line of Claudio's, which is I to die, to go we know not where. And
you know what? Hold on to that thought, only because they're playing our song and we're talking about a new production called Isabella here in Philadelphia. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hear the stories of extraordinary Americans who rose, fought, and prevailed during humanity's darkest.
I never questioned the necessity of that war.
And finest hour.
No one could go through this and not change.
From director Ken Burns, a series critics are calling brilliant, a masterpiece, an unforgettable experience. The War. Starting September 23rd on WHYY-TV.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This week on The Sound of Young America, I visit comedian Paul F. Tompkins, who, as it happens, can do a pitch-perfect impression of my dad.
Your mom doesn't let you stay up this late, right? That's why Dad is number one! And the cat's in the cradle and the sewers.
This week on The Sound of Young America from PRI, Public Radio International. Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's Daytime News Magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, here and now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The Philadelphia Live Arts Philly Fringe Festival gets underway this Friday. It runs through September 15th. Artists will be performing at venues and neighborhoods all across the city. Pig Iron Theater Company is presenting Isabella, their reworking of Shakespeare's play Measure for Measure. It's set in a hospital morgue and explores questions about death and desire. Dan Rothenberg directs this theater production of Isabella, also founding member of Pig Iron Theater and one of the three artistic directors. Charles Conwell plays the mortician, the Duke, in this production of Isabella. He's also a professor at the University of the Arts, where he created the stage combat program back in 1985. Also with us is Lissy Stossel. She's the associate set designer, makeup designer for Isabella, and she's also a graduate student at the University of Virginia. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Dan, before the break, you were talking about these key lines, I guess, from Shakespeare that you've, in a sense, sort of built this play around, these lines about, you know, who desire and death and the body.
Yeah, I think I was talking about that I see this piece not so much as an adaptation, but as this original work that translates these couple of lines. One was this line of Angelo's about imagining himself lying next to a flower, and when the sun hits him, that he rots while the flower grows. Mm-hmm. And then the second line is, I to go we know not where, to lie in cold obstruction and to rot. Something which my collaborators and I realized, we've talked about this in a couple of our productions, but that actually, even though we've known each other for 15 or 20 years, that it had never come up.
And
what do you think is going to happen to you after you die?
Right. Can I turn to you? You're smiling there, Charles Conwell. I mean, you were part of these discussions, this thinking about, you know, death and what happens to us after we die.
I really wasn't so much. Well, the first week, I in an ensemble spirit, played a corpse a lot. They weren't quite ready for the mortician yet. But I wasn't part of those discussions. Although there's an interlude in the play where the mortician does face his own death. I look upon the play as a love story.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, let me find out why.
Well, the mortician, or coroner, as I prefer to think of him, falls in love with this beautiful, or in lust, I would say, at first, with this beautiful corpse.
Isabella.
And because he knows Shakespeare, and because he's shy and can't directly approach her, he decides to recreate critical scenes from Measure for Measure in order to win her hand at the end. And she does such a terrific job of playing Isabella that he falls totally in love with her, and as the Duke does in Measure for Measure, he proposes marriage to her. And by the time I get to the end of the play, it's not just the Duke proposing, it's the mortician himself. They become blended.
Well, and there were some scenes, I guess, early on where he begins to fall in love with this woman and takes off the rubber gloves and just slowly caresses her body.
For the first moments of the show, I tried to be absolutely professional and am uninterested in her as a living or as a female body. And then suddenly I look at her, I start with the face, and her face is so striking. And then her body is so beautiful, and that's when I fall in lust with her. And then when she starts acting the scenes, and the woman, I think, Birgit, who plays her, is terrific. She's very passionate, and she has these wonderful eyes. Then he really falls in love with her. It goes beyond lust. Right. So to me, it's a love story.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you see it that way, Dan?
Dan and I are very different.
Oh, you are? Well, that's good. We like that. I want to hear from Lissy as well.
Yes, I mean it's a love story that's deconstructed. I mean, it's opened up. It's a love story in which we watch one person play all the parts. So I absolutely do think that's how Charles's character thinks of it. Mm-hmm. But we watch him make a play on stage. And, you know, it's lovely to hear Charles talk about what a great job the corpses do of performing the play. But actually, I feel, you know, I think they make a real shambles of it. And that's part of what I find really delightful, in that it's in that interplay between him wanting it to be a wonderful romantic story, the character wanting that, and us seeing this middle ground where we get glimpses of that, but also it's an awkward stumbling story. That's where I see the real beauty of the production.
And we should say to our listeners, it really is in many ways a play within a play. So what happens is these dead bodies then begin to perform Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, but almost like a ventriloquist, at least in the beginning, where you, Charles, are moving their mouth as they begin to recite these lines of Shakespeare.
That's true. I have to get everybody started. And I think there's, you know, I think most of us, when we begin a romance, we often imagine all kinds of things about, we look at someone who's good looking and we endow them with intelligence and compassion and humor, and then you get to know them and you're either disappointed or you're not. But so I think the audience can relate to that.
Hmm.
She is a creation of his own mind.
Mine.
And that does come from the Shakespeare, I think. There's this part where he says, do I love her for the things that make her good? You know, do I desire her for those things that make her good? Trying to figure out, why am I placing these? The play is really, it's an absurd situation.
Yes.
of a love story with corpses. That's really about, you know, that's trying to take that impulse that we all have to project feelings and project motives onto other people all the time in all of our conversations and write at large.
How do you see it, Lisey?
Well, I have to say, I keep trying to distance myself from the whole thing and kind of put myself in the audience's seat, because I think we've been working on it for so long, we're all getting very subjective about it.
Yes.
And it might actually not be that easy for some people to accept it as a love story, because to a lot of people it's necrophilia and it's really disgusting, you know. So I mean, for me, I'm a visual person, for me the most interesting thing is the way that these bodies move and interact with each other, and the strangeness that is corpses who are doing things that living people would be doing.
And doing them the way corpses would do them.
Would be doing, right. Yeah. It's kind of a contradiction that's really fascinating to watch.
You had mentioned that there was something about some of the, I guess, tools in a morgue that you found interesting.
Well, one of the surprising things we saw in there was a bread knife. And that, which is, we had
one of the tools of the trade, right?
Exactly, and we sort of, and there's this whole war with, okay, there's what's actually what they would use in the morgue, and then what the audience is going to believe that they would use in a morgue,
right.
And having a bread knife on stage would look kind of funny to the audience, you know.
Conjure up all these strange cannibalistic ideas,
mm-hmm.
or something.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Lissy Stossel. She's associate set designer, makeup designer for Isabella. Charles Conwell, a performer in Isabella. He plays the mortician or the Duke in this production. And Dan Rothenberg directs this theater production of Isabella from, it's part of the Live Arts, Philly Live Arts, Philly Fringe Festival. And it all gets underway tomorrow and it runs for the next couple of weeks. And for more information about the various productions, go to livearts-fringe.org. Lines open here on Radio Times at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dan, let me go back to you and just ask, I guess, a couple of questions in terms of directing people who are dead bodies performing this play Measure for Measure. I mean, in many ways, I would think in theater productions, if you don't have someone's body to work with, you have their voice, and I guess you have certain kinds of gestures. But you can't go too far with that because you're talking about a dead body performing, right?
Say your question.
Well, I'm thinking just how, I guess, how limited you can be in terms of directing someone who's playing a dead body. You have to use their voice, I guess.
It's a funny thing. I mean, Dito Van Reigersberg doesn't get up until 45 minutes into the play. But I think he's giving a tremendously physical performance, actually. And it requires, they're exhausted at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it's clumsily done. It's art. It requires a tremendous amount of concentration to perform as though parts of your body won't obey your will. I mean, for me, the interest in staging, in working with this concept of, oh, it's dead people doing it, is not... one of the things that we found about doing it was that, all right, it was important to move away from an idea of deadness as numbness for this production. Deadness allowed, because of the floppiness and the abandon that we were interested in as a movement quality, it allowed sometimes for really extreme emotions to come through that seemed to me a great way to actually let some of Shakespeare's texts fly out into the audience, to not be, in a way I'm saying that, trying to direct it realistically like a movie, and we would go back and forth and say, okay, let's do the movie version just so we remember what the stakes would be for alive people. That was more limiting. That I found that more limiting than asking people to work imaginatively on, you know, at their edge of what they could and could not do.
Interesting. Do you have thoughts about that as someone who's, I guess, playing? I mean, you're acting with people who are playing dead people. Is that a particular challenge for you, Charles?
No. The challenge, I think, for me is I'm playing a man who has very different impulses. A man much more hesitant, a shyer man, a less powerful man. So that's the tremendous challenge for me. I daren't relax and make a move based on my own impulses. I always have to keep in mind, what would this man do instead? I think the coroner has a crazy imagination, and once they get going, he just accepts it, and he's thrilled that, and that, again, from the coroner's point of view, the corpses are doing a terrific job, better, and the leading lady is doing a job beyond his expectations, so I don't worry too much about them, but I saw in rehearsal, and I see in performance, the tremendous effort they put in, but I don't share that. I have my own problem to deal with.
And we were talking about the actors being naked, and at one point in the play, you do take off your clothes. And I wonder, does that change how you feel on the stage when you're naked?
Surprisingly not.
Surprisingly
when
not.
My first reaction was, well, I'll lose 20 pounds. And then he said, please don't. And then I thought of defying him. And then he sent
me another.
Does it
say something about your relationship?
And I think what's hard is I'm 60 years old, and I used to have a very beautiful body, and you have to get past that vanity. But the great thing was I did the publicity shot. Dan offered. He said, would you like me to do someone else to do that? And I said, no, I'll do it. And I had to stand naked in a dejected manner, and I had to let my stomach muscles go, and there was the Haagen-Dazs gut. And that was the moment of freedom for me. And now I don't even think about the nudity. I'm so busy thinking about being hesitant, and I find the nudity was nothing for me.
No, it's interesting.
I had to get past a certain kind of older male vanity too. But I did that in the photo call.
But I wonder whether, and I was looking at the audience just to see if there was any sort of overt reaction to seeing naked actors. I couldn't discern anything, per se. I mean, I think as a member of the audience, you get used to it after a minute or two.
Sure.
I mean, you've checked out the bodies, and then you kind of move into the play.
Exactly, yeah.
Into the performance.
Well, I think in the very first moment, people hold their breath. Like, it's very
quiet.
It's very quiet in there.
Feel that.
And both about the deadness and about the nakedness.
Mm.
I mean, it's interesting when people are willing to laugh at first, because, again, people aren't used to laughing around nakedness. I was talking earlier about the non-sexy approach to nakedness, and I do think that you get used, you know, you say, maybe I'm not supposed to look. I don't know, I've talked to a few audience people about it, and maybe I'm not supposed to look, and okay, I'm going to look now. And
But you have to look, don't you?
Sure, I mean, sure. Eventually, I think you look and you judge people according to pretty standard ideas about beauty first. And then I think, especially because of the stumblingness of the bodies, you know, my hope is that eventually you go, wow, the human body is so weird looking. Mm-hmm. You know, it's
and so many variations.
Yeah, right? There's so, you know, there's so many everyone's so strange looking like a plant, I think, in the end. You know, some of the pictures we've made have been attempts to turn the human body into just a plant, just a series of symmetries and asymmetries, and invite people to look at it that way.
It's funny that you say.
Missy, go ahead.
It's funny that you say that, because I actually had a sort of psychologically disturbing time when I had to start the research for what dead bodies looked like, and it helped me to think about the different stages of decomposition as rotting fruit. So that's kind of similar to your plant
right.
analogy.
And we know what rotting fruit looks like, right? I mean, just
the discoloration,
look in our refrigerators.
And the swelling and things like that.
And we actually know what meat looks like, too.
Right. But one thing I was going to say is I think that from a makeup perspective, it sort of helps that to have Charles there in comparison to all of these people who are obviously paler and have a different physical appearance than this person who's alive. And I think, I don't know if this is true, or we should ask some audience members, but I think it's more shocking or disturbing when Charles takes his clothes off, just because he's this flesh color, and he's the act of taking the clothes off makes him seem more nude than these corpses.
Because they have, they're painted and mm-hmm. discolored.
And the addition also, when they come in, they seem more naked when they come in with those Elizabethan clothing articles, too. And it makes right. it sort of comedic.
And there are a couple of actors that also have scars, and I'm assuming that's mm-hmm. something that you've also designed and
yeah.
helped to paint on?
No, they're not painted, actually. It's a two-part silicone compound that...
Oh, really?
It's. I think they actually use it to cover flaws in actors on TV and stuff like that. So it acts like skin, so it's very flexible, and we just model that on right before the show.
And one of them has a pretty extensive scarring system there.
Yeah, and that's an autopsy cut. Right. Like, that's the standard right. autopsy scar.
Did you want to add to that, Dan?
No. I'm just
okay.
nodding
All
along
right.
saying, that's a Y cut.
Let me get to Joyce from Bridgeton, New Jersey to join us. Hi, Joyce. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
First, I want to say a special hi to Lisi. I'm a UVA alum.
Oh, hi.
There you go.
My question is this. I'm very curious. My family owns a crematorium. We work with bodies all the time. We work with dozens of morticians. And I'm curious why your mortician is shy, friendless, not very social. Because the ones I know are very bright, funny, well-educated, social people. So I'm just curious why you chose a kind of a stereotypical, I think, character for the mortician.
Well, Joyce, I think that's a really interesting question, and I'm watching the clock here, and we will get the answer to your question after this short break, because we have to take this break, a quick reintroduction for our guests, and then we will take a stab at an interesting question. We're talking with some of the people involved in a new production. It's called Isabella. It's part of the Philadelphia Live Arts Philly Fringe Festival. Dan Rothenberg, director of the new theater production of Isabella, founding member of Pig Iron Theater Company, one of the three artistic directors. Charles Conwell plays the coroner, the mortician, the duke in this production of Isabella. He's also a professor at the University of the Arts, where he created the stage combat program back in 1985. And Lisi Stossel is the associate set designer, makeup designer for Isabella. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
You know what they say about fixing cars?
Yeah, a problem well-defined is a problem half-solved.
The best way I can describe it is a scene from a Three Stooges movie where the three of them are sleeping in the same bed. I don't know if you remember that. But Moe goes, and Larry goes, woo, and Curly goes, woo, 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 woo.
Remember it?
We got that picture hanging right on the wall.
All right.
We're Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers. Join us for Car Talk.
Saturday morning at 10 on WHYY. On the next Fresh Air, we continue our hard rock and heavy metal series. Led Zeppelin's Robert Plant reveals the true meaning of Stairway to Heaven, and Aerosmith's Steven Tyler and Joe Perry describe life in one of the most successful and self-destructive hard rock bands. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Next time on Day to Day, few students are really well educated in responsible drinking when they first get to college.
Some people didn't have the chance when they're in high school, so they go crazy with it.
School administrators agree. The question is, what can they do about it?
We can deny it, we can try to legislate it away, but in fact, it is a presence.
Colleges trying to put the cap on binge drinking, next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking about Pig Iron Theater Company's production of Isabella. It's a new play that they're premiering at the Philadelphia Fringe Live Arts Festival, and it's drawn from Shakespeare's play Measure for Measure. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Dan Joyce wanted to know, you know, why these sad sack mortician portrayals. Go ahead.
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to say that this piece is a fantasy, not a social documentary. I actually agree with Joyce. We interviewed a few morticians, and they are remarkable people in general. And I agree that when we were at a mortician's funeral director's convention, they said, you know, these are some of the funniest people I've ever met. They were saying,
right.
And I agreed with them, and then sort of regaled us for a couple of hours with, you know, had us all rolling on the floor. I really have a real awe and respect for what morticians do. This mortician's shyness is really about finding a space where he was going to manipulate other people. You know, it's a piece about death and sex, which led us to the iconic image of a morgue. But the loneliness which allows you to talk to yourself and talk for other people. But actually, you know, as Charles was saying, the challenge for him is playing someone quite different from himself, and that's, I think, very much that Charles is cast against type here, because Charles does not look like an undertaker. He does not look like a tall, skinny, skeletal fingers.
Careful. Don't go too far there.
I'm talking about the stereotype
of course.
Of the Undertaker, the sort of Disney Bugs Bunny Undertaker, and very much wanted someone who's, though that I've asked Charles to play as a very shy and introverted person, that I'm really tapping into this character, you know, the actor and the character's capacity for tremendous imagination.
Do you want to add anything to that?
Well, I would say this. It's important to remember that no good play is written about well-adjusted people.
Because who would go, right?
Well, no, you wouldn't have a play. If the coroner were well-adjusted, if he had friends, the action of the play wouldn't happen. If Hamlet was well-adjusted, he'd go back to Wittenberg and we wouldn't have Hamlet. So I think good plays are about poorly adjusted people.
Mm. About conflicts and turmoil and questions.
Yeah, because as much as I admire well-adjusted people, they don't have a lot of conflicts and dramatic interest.
Fair enough. Let me get another call. Joyce, thanks for the call. We've got Dan from Plymouth Meeting joining us. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I just had a question about the actors actually playing dead people. As an actor myself, where do you get the motivations for what you do on stage as a dead person? Because I work a lot from experience, and obviously you don't experience being dead. So that's, how do they actually transmit that on stage?
Well, it's a good question, Dan, and I guess I'm back to Dan Rothenberg.
Yeah, I wish we had some of the actors playing dead folks here. That question of, I mean, I think you've really hit on what's most exciting about the project from an actor's point of view, which is how do you play not based on experience but based on imagination, and especially on imagining the unimaginable, imagining not being. In terms of, I mean, Pig Iron starts with a very physical approach to character. The training that our performer creators have is to approach characters not just as sequences of motivations and psychological motivations, but as rhythms of bodies in space. So that's part of my work with them. What's interesting is as we've just opened the piece, there is still a series of, even though our focus is so non-psychological, there are a series of motivations that each of these actors go through. But because they are playing half-blinded, half-stumbling objects, the motivations are both very extreme and very mundane. So the motivations are, I'd really like to move my arm now. I sort of remember doing this gesture when I was alive, but I can't quite remember what it was. And I want to go over to that refrigerator and go inside. And then suddenly this enormous motivation of, I know that my body's going to be torn apart and I'm terrified about it, and I'm going to speak from that place. So,
interesting. I mean, and what I observed was just the eyes. I mean, sort of having eyes that didn't see. I mean, they're open, but they don't see.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that you've hit on a really... Some of the founders trained at a school in Paris called Lecoq, and he was really interested in how you create a space with the gaze. And in terms of my work with the actors here, it's been very much about concentrating on the gaze and concentrating on communicating to the audience that we don't see, which I think is also connects to that non-sexiness that I was talking about. And they don't know that they're naked, and you know instinctively and viscerally, because of how they're using their eyes, that these creatures cannot compose themselves, cannot wear clothes, are not aware that they are naked, stumbling, pretty, not pretty. They have other motivations.
Let me, I'm just watching the clock here, and I'm just curious about each one of you and how you came to acting. And what intrigues me, Charles Conwell, about you is this stage combat program that you created at the University of the Arts. And you worked with operas and opera companies and other theaters.
I work regularly with Opera Delaware and the Opera Company of Philadelphia. I worked once at the Metropolitan Opera, very exciting.
And it's staging then...
I stage any kind of fight, a lot of sword fights, but I'm prepared to do any kind of fight.
Does that mean you can do all this yourself, that you are a sword fighter? And
I can fake everything.
Well, that's where I was going. It's like, so you can make it look like a sword fight.
Yes, but I would probably be killed very fast or lose a fencing match very quickly.
What got you interested in that?
As a kid, I always loved the Errol Flynn movies, Stuart Granger, Jose Ferrer. And like most of my life, it was an accident. I went to the Colorado Shakespeare Festival in 1965, and they had stage combat training, which at that time was very rare in America. And I just, there I was, and I got it.
And, and you've been doing it ever since?
I actually ignored it for 20 years, and then someone found me and...
reminded you.
I directed a lot of Shakespeare, and I just did the fights because I thought that's what directors did. I never heard of a fight director.
But I would think staging it for the stage, you know, for theater, is so different from the movies. I mean, movies you can edit, you can make things look so real, and on stage,
it's a tremendous difference. The biggest difference is in the movies you can hire real fencers.
Exactly.
I have to take the singer who's hired because he can sing and the actor who's hired because he can act and make the best of it. Now, through the efforts of the Society of American Fight Directors, we have more and more actors who are trained. But anyone over 40 probably has no combat training. Right. So that's the hard part, and yes, you have, and you can stop. You can do a few moves in the movies and stop. We have to do the whole thing.
So part of it is choreography, I guess, and part of it is just mental, physical training.
Yeah, well, it's all choreographed. I do no improvisation, and it takes a lot of rehearsal. I think it's very hard because any singer or actor has to look like they're trying to kill their partner. And at the same time, you have to do a number of things to guarantee your partner's safety. And those are very uneasy bedfellows.
The risk of being
hurt. Trying to do keep someone safe and look like you're killing them.
Go ahead, Dan.
You know, I just wanted to say that one of the pleasures of working with Charles is that he's such a physical performer because of all this background and because of his understanding that yes, you could choreograph every look and every breath, which we do in Pig Iron. So we founded the company as 20 somethings and now we're 30 somethings, and we knew for this piece we wanted to find a physical performer who was of a generation older than we, and Charles has all the you know, Charles, even though he has learned a lot of our vocabulary of physical acting here, he's got it all wired into him from all of the fight choreography work that he's done.
More like just a linguistic change. And is this your first collaboration then?
It is.
Interesting. And, I mean, a different experience for you?
Oh, it's like, work this way? It's like,
so collaborative?
It's a big adventure. I mean, I've directed and adapted over a dozen Shakespeare. And like George Bush, I'm used to being the one who decides. And I put all that aside, and for the last 7 weeks, it's been Dan who decides. Mm. I do no improvisation. They do improvisations right and left. They exhaust me with their 45-minute warm-up. But I've had a great time.
Right. Does it make you think differently, though, about theater?
It's made me feel younger.
That's a good thing.
I don't know if it's... you have to wait till I direct my next play before I could say if it's changed me.
Because sometimes you don't know that right away, right? I mean,
yeah,
things can work on you. And to you, Lisa, I'm curious about your interest in design and makeup.
Mm-hmm. Well, I first met Pig Iron when they came and did a residency at my school at UVA this January, and they performed Tell Me It's Henry Halfway there, and I was really interested in their work. I'm especially interested in them because they often perform in unusual spaces, and I'm writing my thesis on site-specific theater. I'm a set design student at UVA in graduate school. And so I asked them if they had any work for me, and... they said, well, we have a designer already. You can be the associate designer. But they were looking at my pictures, and I have a visual arts background, and I'm specifically in painting. And so I guess that's why they invited me to do the, you know, very clinically realistic body makeup.
And Pig Iron goes back to, what, 1995?
Yeah, so the founders were, we came out of a liberal arts college in Philly, Swarthmore.
Right.
So... that's where the collaborators met and started sharing their enthusiasms and dissatisfactions.
And what were those dissatisfactions about?
Oh, I think a sense that theater could be more than a literary art form, you know, even though, you know, some of us care a lot about literature, read a lot of books, I do, that theater itself is made up of entrances and exits and fleshy bodies on stage breathing, and that was where we wanted to put our attention together. And because it's a group of people communicating and breathing with this other group of people, the audience, you know, that was something that we needed to train together to learn about and to explore.
Do you think audiences don't need a certain kind of training as well? Because I think in many ways with theater, you know, expecting the entrances and the exits and the sort of traditions of theater. And when you go to something that's a little different, it's intriguing, it's scary sometimes.
Well, I mean, this is probably our most challenging piece for sure for an audience. I mean, in terms of how much we are willing to teach the audience the language. But we do think about that. We think about how do we invite the audience in and teach them this language? And I think our favorite thing to hear is, oh, you know, I don't like theater, but I like that. So, I mean, we live in a kind of uneasy dance with real theater lovers. Some of the comments that we receive, I take as compliments to that. Are you improvising all the lines?
Right.
You know, when actually, as I said, often it is really choreographed down to the breath, but because of our focus on the whole ensemble being invested in creating the whole world, as opposed to, well, this is my character and this is the beginning and end of my job, I think that's what gives that feeling of aliveness to audiences, that, oh, well, maybe they're just making everything up.
Well, and I'm curious, go ahead, Charles.
Come to Pig Iron, you should come for the unexpected. And that seems to me the fun of Pig Iron.
But I would think, as someone who's acted for a fairly long time, that you do get an ability to read an audience, to kind of feel, are they with you? Are they uncomfortable? Are they angry? I don't know.
I think in other roles I'm able to do that. And I find I have so much to think about that I don't think I can gauge the audience
really
except for an occasional laugh, right, in the show. It's just, there's no rest for my mind.
Hmm. So we're just sort of invisible to you.
Well, I know you're there, but I really don't have the liberty, because if I relax my thought process, I do something impulsive and be in trouble.
Can't do that.
Right. Other roles, I can gauge the audience, mm-hmm, I think.
And is that
something? And that's something that may come in time. I've only given one performance, so maybe, you know, ask me next week and I may be a little more comfortable and I'll be able to have that part of my mind to gauge the audience.
And I guess we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, it's a premiere, first night. You know, you have to, I assume,
lot of people. You know, I mean, I think for every, even for people who work with me for 15 years, one of the things that I've said to the actors is there isn't a lot that you can rely on when you do this piece. You know, you can't say, well, it's not going very well, I think I'll go faster and bigger, mm-hmm, because the style is so demanding from people.
And I think it's safe to say the audience will never have seen anything like this.
I would agree with
that. If you want to see something unique, come and see us.
Well, and I wonder whether between this afternoon, I mean, do you go back to the drawing board and sort of go through what went right, what didn't, how to sort of fix it for the next production?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of why we, for the next performance. I mean, and actually we even have works in our repertory for several years that we'll still talk about. Okay. We still do notes and work things and change things. And, you know, I don't think of the... Even though I say that everything's choreographed, the way it gets choreographed is over time doing the research with the audience and talking about it and saying, okay, well, this was a happy accident, or this actually doesn't work. Let's just take that out. And it seems very important that the work remain alive and changing.
And go ahead.
And this is actually the third stage of this production, right? Because it's already been workshopped a couple times, correct?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, on that note, I thank all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Lisi Stossel, Charles Conwell, Dan Rothenberg, our guests today on Radio Times. We were talking about Pig Iron's production of Isabella, part of the Live Arts Fringe Festival here in Philadelphia. For more information, go to livearts-fringe.org. And to find out more about Radio Times, go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out about podcasts and drop us an email. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.